Is baptism a mere symbol of rebirth? Is it a prize for attaining a certain amount of faith? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May is Lutheranism 101, Holy Baptism. It's written by regular guest Pastor Charles Lehman. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Lutheranism 101, Holy Baptism by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Lutheranism 101, Holy Baptism. I suppose that some kind of hostility between Islam and Christianity as opposed worldviews has existed ever since Islam came on the scene. And in a lot of ways, not only in its holy books, challenged Christianity. But the challenge wasn't only religious or theological, it was also political, it was also military. Is that ancient history? Is that old Islam? Is the Islam of the 21st century? Has it ceased hostilities, political, otherwise, toward Christianity, toward a Christian worldview? Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. on this Monday afternoon. It's the 20th of May. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. In the first hour, we're going to be talking about Christian persecution under Islam. Raymond Ibrahim is going to join us. In the second hour of the program today, it's the first Pentecost with Dr. Arthur Jess. Coming off of Pentecost Sunday, we want to talk about the nature of the very first Pentecost as we find it in the New Testament. Raymond Ibrahim is Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum, and author of a new book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. Mr. Ibrahim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Happy to be with you.
Why are Christians apparently, and maybe it's just apparent, but why are they apparently singled out today, especially in Muslim-controlled countries, for persecution? I can't think of another word for it.
Right. There is no other word for it. The reason is, well, there are several reasons. One of the main reasons is historic, which is basically the fact that most people are unaware of the fact that what we today call the Arab world, from Morocco to, you know, Iraq, Syria, even Turkey, which is really not the Arab world, but part of the Middle East, all of these nations were all Christian before the advent of Islam in the 7th century, as you were pointing out. And they were taken over, of course, in the early Islamic jihadi conquest from the 7th century on, bit by bit. And again, you know, to give you an idea of how Christian they were, if you took the population of the entire world, the Christian population in the 7th century, more than half lived in those lands that we just mentioned, the Arab world in the Middle East. So because of that fact, there's still large pockets of them in certain areas, for example, Egypt, which was a major Christian country before Islam, and in fact, it had actually a very strong role in ecumenical councils and such before the Council of Chalcedon, that is, and gave giants like Origen and Clement and Athanasius, etc. So that's why, that's one reason you have a lot of Christians still in these countries. The other reason is that Christianity, you know, beginning with Christ, is the one religion that has always been, for lack of a better word or a phrase, in your face and not willing to back down, just as Jesus did, you know, in front of Pontius Pilate. You know, all he had to do was utter some words, play along, and he could have gotten out of it, but he didn't. The disciples were the same thing. The early Christians were the same thing. And until now, this is what you're having in the Islamic world. You know, we have this Abedini, who's an Iranian of descent, but he's a U.S. citizen, and he's right now in Iran, imprisoned, being tortured, and being asked to recant, to renounce Christ. And again, he's not. And this story plays over and over. If you look in the book, Crucified Again, you'll find many incidents of, you know, Muslim converts to Christianity who want to be Christian, and they're not hiding it. And then they're attacked, or Christians who just are upfront about the religion. Other religions, you have to keep in mind, and chief among them is Islam, believe it or not, actually allows its followers to dissemble their beliefs if that will save their lives. In other words, it's the antithesis of Christianity, in that if you're a Muslim and you're around, let's say, hostile non-Muslims who are hostile to Islam, you are actually permitted by Islamic law to renounce Islam outwardly, to curse Muhammad, as long as in your heart you're still a believer. So this component, which is in other variants, for example, the Baha'is, who are in Iran and other areas, they also regularly dissemble their beliefs. The Shia, the Muslims, they're well known also for hiding their beliefs. But Christianity has this component of it doesn't hide its belief, it's up front, it's in your face with it, and that, of course, always irks supremacist non-Christians, chief among them being the Muslims.
When you say supremacist, flesh out that term. In the Islamic worldview, why can we rightly refer to it as supremacist?
It's supremacist because if you look at its very nature, from the very beginning with Muhammad in the 7th century, he was weak in the beginning. He didn't have any followers. He was outnumbered in the first 10 years of his ministry. He only had about 15 people. He was ridiculed. He was ostracized, and that's why there's this idea that not many people know of in the Quran. Half of those verses were spoken during that time when he was weak. And that's where you get, moderately tolerant verses that are not hostile, that say things like, you have your religion, I have mine, there's no coercion in religion, et cetera, et cetera. And then when he became stronger, he immediately went on the war path and he started winning. And right when he started winning and the first battle of Badr, and he went and he attacked, it was a caravan raid. And they got plunder and booty, and then a lot of the Arabs who were pagans started joining him because he was winning on the warpath. So from the very beginning, Islam was associated, not in the beginning. In the beginning it was weak, but when it became strong, that was proof that it is the religion of God. It's the true religion because it won on the battlefield. And then, of course, the Islamic conquest, which I was alluding to earlier, really solidified this idea that this is the correct religion. And so the supremacist concept comes, it's part and parcel of the might of Islam, its might at arms and at war and battle. And then this also became codified in its worldview vis-a-vis non-Muslims, for example, Christians, who are considered what's called dhimmis, or basically, third class, barely tolerated citizens who are allowed to exist and practice the religion as long as they, keep a very low profile. They can't exhibit a cross. They can't exhibit a Bible. They can't even build a church. They just have to, be very quiet and be thankful that they just exist. And so you can see how all of this plays into the supremacist concept. Quran 9:29, which is really the cornerstone of Islam's militancy, basically states, it commands Muslims to fight those among the people of the book, which is understood in Islamic exegesis as Jews and Christians primarily, fight them until they pay jizya, which is basically tribute or really extortion, money that they pay in order to safeguard their lives. So fight them until they pay jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. So you can see how all this plays into this supremacist mentality.
What's the, you kind of touched upon it right there at the end of your response. What is the ultimate goal according to the Islamic worldview vis-a-vis Christianity?
The ultimate goal of the Islamic worldview, which again began with the Islamic conquests, you have to remember these conquests were very dramatic, what they did to world history. And you won't get this anymore in history books, the way they're whitewashed. But they really took a huge expanse of land. Europe, which then became the only Christian area, we were talking earlier about how the Middle East itself was a big Christian part. But Europe was now the final besieged Christian area. And Islam went so far as into Spain, into France. And then in the east, it went all the way took Turkey, which was Anatolia, and then it went into the Balkans under the Ottoman Empire. So Christianity was always, getting smaller and smaller on all sides. And the ultimate view was seen that Islam's goal, and they still say this, or its destiny, was to take over the world and to subjugate it. And they still, to this very day, if you, like I do, listen to Arabic sermons or Islamic sermons in the Arabic language, you'll hear them saying time and again, this is our goal. They say things like the Vatican will one day pay us jizya, pay us tribute, and be subdued, and the West itself will come to its knees. So all these ideas have not changed. And this is why it's amazing when you see the disconnect in Western discourse about what's going on with the Islamic world, because these things are so clear, they're so documented. What we're seeing today is it just evinces immense continuity with what we saw yesterday, and it all makes sense. It fits an exact pattern, and I actually demonstrate this in the book often. I show you how, you know, I'll quote a historical text talking about what happened to a group of Christians in their church, and then I'll move fast forward to today, and it's the same exact pattern. You'll think you're reading the same story. And so, you know, to succinctly put, yes, the ultimate worldview, and if you want the legalistic terms, it's basically in Arabic, Dar al-Islam, which means the abode of Islam, versus Dar al-Harb, which is the abode of war. And that's really all the world that is not governed according to Islamic law. And so the abode of Islam, or where Islamic law is practiced, and the caliphate, their job is to subsume these lands under its governance.
So with only about a minute before we take our first break, is it safe to say that in the Islamic worldview, the very existence of Christianity is a challenge to them that they feel compelled to overcome?
Certainly. You know, apologists will tell you that Islam allows you to be a Christian, this and that, and it's true, technically speaking, but what they don't tell you is you're allowed to be a Christian, but then any number of debilitations are put forth on you, and we can hopefully talk about this later, the conditions of Omar, which are basically, you want to be a Christian, okay, but you have to follow X, Y, and Z, and you have to pay money, and basically what it did is, even though it's saying you can be a Christian, but it makes the life of a Christian so intolerable that most people, especially who are not that religious, just end up converting. And that's the whole story of how the Islamic world came into being. And that's really the ultimate goal. It's a nominal freedom, but it's put in a mechanism that just makes people, unless they're diehard, very pious, willing to die, or at least live miserable, they just end up converting.
Raymond Ibrahim is our guest. He's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum. He's author of the new book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. When we come back, we are going to talk about some of those conditions, the conditions under which you are permitted in Islam-dominated areas to remain a Christian. And they are not just oppressive. They do smack of persecution. What's different between how Islam has waged war in the past against Christianity and how it does today wage war, the same war? We'll be right back.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India.
Sweden. Egypt.
France. Turkey.
Japan. Australia.
Canada. United Kingdom.
Hong Kong. Austria.
Finland. Malaysia.
Singapore. Bulgaria.
Korea. Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Monday afternoon, May the 20th, we're talking about Christian persecution under Islam. Raymond Ibrahim is our guest, Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum, and author of the new book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Raymond, talk about some of those specific conditions under which Christians in Islamic-controlled areas are permitted, I guess we should say, in rather bolded quotes, religious freedom.
Sure, Todd. This starts with, it's called the Conditions of Omar, and this is a reference to the second caliph, Omar. And during one of, under his reign, which was from 634, 634 to when he died, right around 640, most of the lands of what are called the Arab world were conquered, including Egypt and Syria, and Jerusalem was conquered under him, and Libya, and so forth. And according to Islamic tradition, he made a pact through his deputies with a conquered Christian community that's either believed to be in Syria or possibly in Jerusalem itself. And in this pact, which is called the Conditions of Omar in Arabic, it lays out what Christians must do in order to be left unmolested. And among them are the following. You cannot build a new church. Churches that are already in existence should be left alone, but they cannot be repaired. They're to be left alone until they just die by themselves. You cannot display anything that has to do with Christianity. You can't show a cross. You can't have a Bible with you. You can't talk around Muslims about Christianity. You certainly can't criticize Islam or say anything that can be construed as negative about Islam or its prophet. A house of a Christian cannot be as tall as a house of a Muslim. Christians have to wear distinct garments that are, in certain ways, were actually very humiliating, and it made them stand out so everyone knows this is a Christian. And it really goes on and on to the point that it even literally says if a Muslim wants your seat, you have to get up and give it to him. So this kind of gives you an idea. It sounds like, the way blacks were treated in America before the civil rights movement. It's that mentality, except it was much, much worse, of course, because now we're talking about the 7th century mentality. And so these were all among, now based on, this is what the Conditions of Omar states, but according to the Islamic jurists, because in Islam there's a mechanism which is called in Arabic qiyas, which means analogy. So based on these conditions, then the jurists were able to apply more conditions that are harmonious with these. And in the end, as we were pointing out, so then the Christian does have freedom, but it's very nominal. It's, it's left and right. You're harried. You're not even a citizen. You're paying extortion money. And if you don't, your life becomes forfeit. And, you can't anything you say. And then, of course, there's the cultural component, which many people miss. Many people really focus on Islamic law and Islamic teachings. But what you got to keep in mind is if you're a Muslim and you grow up in this environment, even if you are unlearned in Islam, it's inevitable that you will start having a very low view of Christians. And this, is again, goes back to the supremacist idea, because you know enough from seeing these laws and hearing about them. And they're, by the way, still being taught they're still being taught right now in Muslim schools around the Islamic world. So if you're a Muslim and you hear this, you grow up, and you're going to, of course, have this sort of contemptuous attitude towards Christians. And that's why even a lot of the persecution that occurs, and I document in Crucified Again, it's Christians are singled out because they're Christians, but those Muslims who are doing these things are oftentimes, they don't know Islamic law, but they just have a hatred that has been instilled based on these laws and based on the culture that comes from it towards Christians, and you see this all the time.
So it is built into Islam as a culture to have this kind
Certainly.
Of regard for, and it's considered absolutely normal?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. In Islamic law, if you are a jihadi or you're battling Christians, and in the midst of the war, you can, of course, according to Islamic law till this day, you can have captives of war. And any female captive that you have, it's free for you to have sexual relations with her, because she becomes literally a sex slave. That's what they're called in the Quran, in translation, that which your right hands possess. So they're even, you know, they're not even humans. They're just like possessions that you have, and you do what you want with it. Okay. Now, technically, this should only happen when you're at war with Christians during the context of a jihad. But because of this law, and when Muslims, you know, they grow up around this idea, so then even when you're not at war, it's inevitable for a Muslim to look at a Christian woman and then treat her as a possession. And that's precisely what's happening. It's well documented in my book, all around the Islamic world. Oftentimes, the very first victims of the Islam, these kinds of Muslims are women, Christian women. And they are regularly abducted, they're raped, they're just discarded at will because they're subhumans, and that's how the Islamic mindset sees them, because of these laws. And you can see how all that works together. I mean, it's in Egypt. There's at least over documented, there's over 500, I think 50 cases of Coptic Christian girls who've been abducted, raped, forced into marriage, shamed into marriage, forced to convert to Islam, et cetera, just in the last couple of years. And it's the same story if you go to Pakistan. You find all the time, and this is one of the worst nations, in my opinion, for Christians, women and boys and little girls, you know, pre-puberty children, constantly being sexually abused. And then when you read the reports and you hear from the human rights organizations, they'll even point out what I just said, which is, you know, to a lot of Muslims, they see Christians as just subhuman possessions to have fun with.
So why do we fail to understand this, not only kind of generally as a culture, but those who have real decision-making power, especially in the West, why do they either appear to misunderstand Islam so fundamentally vis-a-vis Christianity, or if they do understand it, they fail to make their decisions accordingly?
Right. This is a very important question, and there's different aspects to it. There's a lot of different and important aspects to it. One of them, of course, is, you know, the mainstream media. You know, if you read this book, Crucified Again, you just won't believe it. You'll think to yourself, how is this happening, and I haven't heard of it, or I barely heard of it as kind of an aberration that's happening here and there, when in fact it's just endemic all around the Islamic world. So one of the reasons is, you know, the vast majority of, I would say, Americans just have no clue because they've been kept in the dark by the mainstream media. So that's one reason. And another reason is, you know, I think a lot of societies, especially American society, Western societies, they tend to project their own worldview onto others. And so here we're living in 21st century America, and whether you're a Christian or whether you're an atheist or a secularist, these ideas, you know, there's a certain ideas of tolerance and human rights and the idea that religion is always a spiritual affair. It's not something that, you know, comes into the world or into your actual actions vis-a-vis real people, because, of course, that's how Christianity is understood. So, again, we project Christianity on other religions. So I think it's just so hard to begin to understand all this because, in a way, we're stuck in our mind, and we think everyone ultimately thinks the way we do. Then there's the arrogant aspect to it, which is basically, even if they don't, even if they really believe all of this Islamic teaching stuff, it's just a matter of time, and then they'll come around. And once they come around, and once their economic conditions are improved and their political conditions are improved, then surely they're going to liberalize and become like us. So there's really a lot of factors in play here. And one of the reasons I can say this is, you know, my family's from Egypt, and I was born and raised here. So in a way, I can see both worlds. I can see and understand how both cultures think. And I'm convinced that, you know, I understand the Islamic world, but I can see why an American who has no acquaintance or experience with it firsthand would just be oblivious to understanding any of this, because they're just not exposed to it in any way, shape, or form. It's dissembled in the media, you know, it's whitewashed. If you go to school in academia, you know, from the smallest, from, you know, grade school to the Ivy League, I'm sure you'll agree, you know, Christianity is always portrayed as the bad guy, if anything. Historically, Christianity is the one that is the intolerant religion. It's, you know, a bunch of white imperialists who were using religion so they can take over lands, et cetera, and it's always given a very cynical view. And I think, you know, and then the flip side of that is, you know, non-Christian people, and this is the multicultural aspect, non-Christian people are the victims, they're noble, and, you know, we can learn from them, and et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things have just been ingrained in the Western mindset that it makes, you know, it makes us blind to see reality. And the final point, of course, is political correctness, which in many ways just paralyzes people from not just speaking. You see, if you can't speak the truth, it gets to a point where you can't even think it. And your mind can't even register or connect the dots anymore. So I think all of these factors, to go back to your question, are behind the reason that we're so blind to what's happening.
Obviously, a failure to see this has both short and long-term consequences. With only about a minute here before our break, what would you say is the primary consequence, immediate consequence, of failing to recognize what Islam is, what its aims are globally and with regard to Christianity?
Well, the immediate consequence is that what began in the 7th century, which is Islamic domination, hegemony, and essentially cleansing out infidels, will continue and will immediately, that will be, well, that's what we'll see. We're seeing that right now in Iraq. You know, since the last 10 years, well more than half of the indigenous Christian population has been decimated or forced to flee. In Egypt, hundreds of thousands are leaving. In Nigeria, you know, the north where the Muslims are, they've pushed out almost all the Nigerians. In Syria, it's the same story. And in fact, one report says that in the early 20th century, 20% of the Middle East was still Christian, and that now it's about 4%. So the immediate consequence is the complete eradication of Christianity.
Raymond Ibrahim is our guest. We're talking about the persecution of Christians under Islam. It's Monday afternoon, May the 20th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
How would you like to attend a conference and hear Rod Rosenblatt, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, Al Schmidt, Suzanne Vinker, and Todd Wilkin? You're invited to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Late-term abortionist Kermit Gosnell has been found guilty of hundreds of crimes against humanity. His staff testified he cruelly and violently killed hundreds of babies who survived the abortions. 72-year-old Gosnell is now spending the rest of his life in jail with no chance of parole. Justice has been carried out, but God still loves him and wants this former abortionist in heaven with him. That's why I and my fellow pro-life leaders are requesting everyone pray for the salvation of Kermit Gosnell. Pray that while this man's sitting in his jail cell, the Holy Spirit would prick his conscience and turn his heart toward God. Pray that Gosnell will then witness to his fellow inmates about the love and forgiveness found only in Jesus, and that God's kingdom will grow.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Raymond Ibrahim is our guest. He's author of the new book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. We're talking about Christian persecution under Islam. Let's go to some specific examples, if we could, to the various places that are currently under the political control of Islam in one form or another. What would be, and let's start with something more recent, namely the Arab Spring and Egypt that you mentioned before, one of those places where these changes were initially hailed by many in the U.S., many in the West, as positive changes for everyone in Egypt. What would you say, in light of everything you've talked about, the goals of Islam, what would you say how we ought to view the Arab Spring?
Sure, Todd. Actually, you bring up a great point, which works well with what we were talking about. So, I mean, going back to the media, for example. So, again, in the media, the Arab Spring came about, or the so-called Arab Spring, and it was immediately articulated in a very Western, secular paradigm. We were told that, you know, Arabs are sick and tired of dictators, they want freedom, they want democracy, they want liberty. And all that made sense and jibed very well with Western sensibilities, because that's how the West thinks. But then you come to find out that was only partially true. Yes, they did want freedom from the yoke of dictatorship, but it was not to bring about democracy and liberty and freedom. And let me just qualify that by saying not all of them. Certainly there are nominal Muslims, and there are, for example, if we're talking about Egypt, there was a big Christian Coptic community, and there were a lot of those who did want to try to bring a sort of, at least a more liberal or secular environment. But the people that are called Islamists, of course, took over. They did have more numbers. They were helped by the Obama administration, and that's another thing we can get into. But so it's a perfect example of how something was portrayed in the West in a certain way, when in fact it really was a different paradigm. So what happened is basically now you have the Muslim Brotherhood is in charge, and this is a group that actually it's the granddaddy of all the Islamic organizations, including Al-Qaeda. And now it's in charge. And if you look, of course, at the Muslim Brotherhood's doctrines and teachings and worldview, they're no different than Al-Qaeda. The only difference is their tactics, which are basically to preach nonviolence, to do things incrementally, kind of a grassroots approach, condition society, make people on your side, win Muslims over and make them want to, you know, have Islamic Sharia law, which is always portrayed like a great thing. So really, Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, it's just the same ideas, but they're implemented differently. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's ideas were more effective simply because of their stealth nature, which we can get into a little bit. But so what happened is they took over, and right away you're seeing now the true face of the Arab Spring, not just in Egypt, by the way. You're seeing it in Libya. It's coming to Syria. Even in moderate Tunisia, which was long hailed the most secular Arab nation in the world, now post-Arab Spring, you're seeing a more intolerance to Christians. You're seeing more attacks on churches. You're seeing Christians going to jail, being attacked under accusations of being blasphemers and saying something negative against Muhammad, which you didn't see, for example, under the Mubarak era. And so all of those things that we were talking about earlier, the conditions of Omar and the treatment of Christians, now they're coming back. It's the same continuity, and there should not be a surprise, because the Arab Spring enabled those Muslims who want to bring the totality of Sharia law. And all the while, we didn't see that, and we weren't told that. But it's also important to keep in mind that outside of the Arab Spring, and this is a point that I really try to stress in the book, it's that, you know, you can go from one end of the Islamic world to the other. So outside of the Arab world, you can go into sub-Saharan Africa, whether it's Nigeria or Sudan or Kenya or Somalia or Uganda. You can go up north to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Turkey. You can go to the Far East, Indonesia, Philippines, Malaysia, the Maldives. These are all countries that, you know, they're not the same race, not the same ethnicity, not the same nationality, not the same languages, not the same cultures. they absolutely have nothing in common. They don't share the same socioeconomic circumstances. And you're going to find the same exact pattern coming to Christians there. So what is the common denominator of all these countries? And it is Islam. All of these countries that I mentioned, even though they're so divergent, they are all Islamic countries or have a very large Islamic population. And so you see the same patterns in Nigeria are happening in Egypt, are happening in Indonesia. And to me, this is one of the most ironclad facts, the most indisputable facts, that what's happening to Christians is an Islamic phenomenon, because it's not localized to one nation or one culture or one race, but rather it's spread everywhere that Islam is.
Okay, then go into a little more depth on the stealth nature. You gave as an example the Muslim Brotherhood, and many people will probably say, well, look, yes, maybe Islam took up arms formally against a Western Christian world in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, but except for terrorism today, that doesn't exist. What's different about the war on Christianity that's stealthier? And therefore, apparently, far more effective.
Well, the stealthy aspect is really, the Muslim Brotherhood in its relations with the West. Around Egyptian Christians, the Muslim Brotherhood shows its face, and they're not tricked. They see it. They're attacked by them constantly. But the stealthy nature is that the Muslim Brotherhood, when it's now, they come to the White House. They're now everywhere in the West. You know, we have CARE, you have all these different Islamic organizations that are founded by the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have a very specific approach, which is basically they look moderate, they wear suits, they don't look like the Salafis, they don't look like, Osama bin Laden. They speak well, they talk about peace, this and that. And again, all this resonates very well with Westerners who want to believe them because they want to believe that Muslims are moderate, et cetera, et cetera. And then you find out that they have a whole different agenda when they're speaking in Arabic to their fellow, to their co-religionists, the Muslims. I'll just give you one example. The motto, the logo, the slogan of the Muslim Brotherhood is basically that the Quran is our constitution, Muhammad or the Prophet is our leader, jihad in the way of Allah is our way, and martyrdom, death in the cause of Allah, our highest aspiration. Now that is a logo that, or a slogan that Al-Qaeda would be proud of. And this is exactly what Mohamed Morsi, the president, when he was running for president, he would say this in Arabic all the time. And this, to me, does not sound like a moderate approach when you're talking about jihad and martyrdom. And when you say the Quran is our constitution, you're saying that Sharia law is what we want, and that is exactly what they want. But you also have to understand there's precedents. Again, I was talking about this earlier about the career of Muhammad and how when he was weak, he preached tolerance, and how when he was stronger, he preached violence. And so the Muslim Brotherhood, they see themselves as in the paradigm of weak Muhammad. So they do what he did, which is to say, yes, peace and let's live in coexistence and this and that. But in the end, their agenda has to be Islamic Sharia law. This is what they say, and this is what Islam is all about. So if that's not what they're trying to do, then, as an organization, they don't even make sense, because fundamentally that is what they want. And that's why, I'll just give you a quick final example. In Egypt, the most radical jihadi terrorists who were jailed and were on death's row because they've assassinated and killed and bombed churches and et cetera, all of these guys are staunch supporters of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, why is that? If they have such a different, worldview, then obviously they wouldn't. But they are, because they, unlike Westerners, understand that the Brotherhood is playing a subtle game of stealth, and they're on the agenda, and they're helping them out.
So we often operate with the distinction that, in light of what you've said here, is obviously far less than helpful, the distinction between Islam and radical Islam. Whenever anything negative occurs, either inside or outside Islam-controlled territories, it is generally associated with radical Islam in some sense. And that's always held in distinction from peace-loving, tolerant Islam. What would be a more helpful distinction to observe?
Sure. A distinction is definitely necessary, but I would offer the distinction is this. And I like to give an example, okay? So apostasy in Islam is considered a capital offense. If you're a Muslim, if you're just born a Muslim, because you don't choose to be a Muslim, if you're born to a Muslim father, then you're a Muslim. So now if you leave Islam, if you want to become a Christian, for example, that is a capital offense according to Islam. This is an ironclad fact. There's no dissembling. There's no way for them to say, no, it's not. It's recorded everywhere. And, you know, the ultimate penalty is death. So if a Muslim were to do this, and inflict this, and in fact, in my book, Crucified Again, you will find numerous Muslims doing this to their fellow Muslims, often family members, because that family member became a Christian. And all of a sudden, they are attacked and sometimes killed. Now, if a Muslim does this, is he being a radical Muslim or is he being a regular Muslim? Obviously, this is part of Islamic law. I can't say that he's doing something out of the ordinary. And yet, there are Muslims who would not do that, but the fact is, they don't have the doctrinal backing. So it's basically like saying, you know, I'm a Jew, but, you know, I eat pork. Does that mean Judaism doesn't allow or Judaism does allow? No, it doesn't. But, you know, what a person does, he can do it. It doesn't necessarily reflect on the teachings of Islam. However, jihadi attacks, killing apostates, killing so-called blasphemers, taking money from, the disenfranchised dhimmis or, you know, Christians who are subjugated. All of these things are part and parcel of Islamic law. So it's impossible to say that if a Muslim is doing it, then somehow he's practicing a perverse or warped version, because it's not. It's doctrinally and historically demonstrable everywhere. But the fact is, yeah, sure, there's some who don't. But that's, if you want to get down to it, and it's sad to say this, it's not because they're moderate Muslims, it's because they're mediocre Muslims, really.
Raymond Ibrahim is our guest. We're talking about the persecution of Christians under Islam. It's Monday, May the 20th. He's Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum, and author of the new book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. We'll have 10 more minutes with him on the other side of the break, and then in hour two on this Monday afternoon, we'll look at the very first Pentecost with Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
The church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Welcome back. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the persecution of Christians under Islam.
Raymond Ibrahim is our guest. Speaking of Islam, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, a regular guest on the program here, is going to be making the case against Islam at the Issues, Etc., Making the Case conference coming up next month, just 25 days away, right here in Collinsville, Illinois. That's only about 15 miles east of St. Louis. The Issues, Etc., Making the Case conference will feature not only Dr. Alvin Schmidt, but also Suzanne Venker, Making the Secular Case Against Feminism, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, Making the Case Against Postmodernism in the Church, Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, he'll be making the case for classical Christian worship, and Dr. Rod Rosenblatt of the White Horse Inn, making the case for Christ alone and against pietism, June the 14th and the 15th at the Issues, Etc., Making the Case conference right here in Collinsville, Illinois. You can get a bulletin insert that your congregation can carry every Sunday and help advertise the conference at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. You'll find the bulletin insert there, or a bulletin paragraph you can insert into your already existing bulletin. It's the Issues, Etc., Making the Case conference. Is only 25 days away. Register online, issuesetc.org. Raymond, I wonder if you would make a further distinction, and that is between westernized Muslims, kind of the Muslim next door, you know, out in the suburbs someplace, and the leaders and the supporters of groups like the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Sure. These Islamic groups, a lot of them, as I was pointing out, were really founded by Muslim Brotherhood members, because the Muslim Brotherhood is it's the hugest organization, and it just has branches all around the world. And as I was saying earlier, they have a very clear agenda, which is basically, you know, to talk with two tongues, a forked tongue, one to Muslims about the ultimate hegemonic aspirations of the Islamic caliphate and its return, and the other to basically speak the Western idiom to Western people of, you know, peace, tolerance, we just want to get along, et cetera, et cetera. So these groups are in America, and they're doing that, and they're very successful, and people are going along with it. Again, it's because it's what, you know, facts are facts, and sometimes they're very hard for people to accept. But if someone says what you believe and your preconceived notions, then immediately that becomes a lot more acceptable. So here I am saying what I'm saying, which isn't exactly, you know, the greatest thing to hear. And then, but I do have facts. I have documentation, and I can, you know, a long paper trail, like I said, doctrinally, historically, and in current affairs. But one of these groups can come and say what you want to hear and which is resonates with your mind, and that oftentimes is considered more valid on an emotional level. So these groups are working. As far as the average Muslim next door, you know, the best way to really understand this, Todd, is to understand the word Muslim, what it means. A Muslim, it comes from the word Islam, and what Islam means is submission, okay? So a Muslim is someone who submits. So what are you submitting to? You are submitting to the laws of Allah as articulated in the Islamic Sharia. Now, if I have a Muslim next door who drinks alcohol and eats pork and you know, shaves his beard, which, by the way, a man, according to Islamic law, has to have a beard, if he can grow it at least, and he's doing all these things, well, I'm not saying that this man is dissembling or anything like that. He could be, but he could be sincere. But at day's end, you know, you have to think, well, so what makes him exactly a Muslim? It's the same thing like, you know, having a Christian who, you know, I say, well, this guy's a Christian, look what he did, a good thing or a bad thing, and yet he doesn't lead a Christian life. He doesn't, you know, do anything that adheres to Christianity. So, sure, you have Muslims who are like that, too, who are nominal, who are secular, who don't know the first thing about their religion, who actually think it's a religion of peace because they don't know much about it. So you do have that group. But what's interesting about that group is I would never really look to that group for help against their co-religionists. And you won't find much outcry from them, you know, when Islamic attacks happen. Usually what they'll say is how now they're going to be victims. You don't hear them really condemning what their co-religionists are doing. So at best, you know, I don't see them as being helpful, but at the same time, the average Muslim next door does not necessarily have to have an agenda, but he could also have an agenda because, as we were discussing, the idea, it's actually a word, it's called taqiyya in Arabic. It's an Islamic doctrine that teaches a Muslim if he's trying to empower Islam, it is permissible for him to lie, to pretend he's not a Muslim, to do all these other things. So that also is a possibility. So that's, you know, really how the best way to really understand these various groups.
So with regard to the U.S. State Department or the current administration, it's not as though, and you've mentioned it several times, it's not as though the facts are not there. Your book is rather well documented when it comes to the specific instances and examples that you give of these things, current day happening in Muslim countries and elsewhere. So how do they digest that information, do you think?
Well, yeah, that's a great point, because, you know, it's one thing to say the mainstream media has fooled the public, but, you know, the White House and the U.S. government is not supposed to be at the mercy of the mainstream media. They should be privy to the greatest intelligence available. And yet they have, much like the Benghazi farce, propagated the idea that Islam is a religion of peace and that Christians are not being persecuted. So what I mean by that is, just like the Obama administration tried to throw blame on a movie when it wasn't about a movie, when it was actually a planned attack that was took place, incidentally, on September 11th, on the anniversary, and the Obama administration went along with that. So it also goes along with the mainstream narrative that, you know, Christian persecution is, you know, either exaggerated or it's really not happening or it's a product of some other grievance and not an intrinsic hostility. But the Obama administration, and I document this in the book, I mean, it doesn't just ignore. This is the first administration which has actually enabled and empowered the persecution of Christians, specifically by its wholesale support for the so-called Arab Spring. You know, I mean, we can go country by country. If you go to Libya, you know, Gaddafi, the Obama administration was well known. He was supporting Al-Qaeda-linked jihadis. We already knew this. And the logic was, well, we're going to get rid of the bad dictator. And the dictator, Gaddafi, said, you know what, you're doing what you did in Afghanistan, you're going to empower Al-Qaeda, and they'll get you. And sure enough, that's what happened with Benghazi. It was the same guys that got rid of Gaddafi, who actually, you know, killed Chris Stevens and the other U.S. Embassy workers. And now in Libya, now that Gaddafi's gone and these guys are in power, you're seeing patterns that you've never seen before coming to Christians, which are a very small population of Libya. So now churches are under attack in Libya, just like they are elsewhere. Nuns who've been in Libya since 1921, helping the sick and needy, have been attacked and driven out. Over 100 Christian cops were caught, tortured. They had their head shaved, and they were mutilated with acid, and one man died, and you saw pictures of them. They look like Holocaust victims, all because they had Bibles in their possession. This never happened under Gaddafi. And now the same thing if you go to Syria. Now, a latest report said 95% of the so-called freedom fighters are not even Syrians. They're jihadis coming from all around the world, just like they did in Afghanistan. That's where Al-Qaeda was born, when the Saudi Osama came and the Egyptian Zawahiri came and all these different jihadis, they came and they formed a base there. So now they're coming to Syria with U.S. foreign aid to oust a secular dictator. And they're going to do the same exact thing. And you're seeing the same thing happening now. Now, Syrians who are tolerated pretty well, Christians in Syria who are tolerated well are being attacked. Their churches are being attacked. They're leaving by the hundreds of thousands. They're being decapitated, held for ransom. Same exact thing that happened in Iraq earlier. So this administration knows what's going on, and it's enabling it. And, you know, one must surmise to himself what is the agenda? What is it exactly? And you know, the fact is, Obama, his background, it's amazing, because even though he's the one president who is enabling this sort of persecution more than anyone else, he's also the one president who should really be acquainted with what's happening on a personal level. After all, his father is a Kenyan Muslim, and he himself was educated as a Muslim in the Indonesian schools. Two countries, by the way, which figure very prominently in my book for their abuse of Christians. And, you know, he has this background, and so he should be a little cognizant or aware of the culture there and what's happening to minorities. And yet, of all presidents, he's the one who's acting like nothing's happening, even as he arms jihadis and terrorists who are attacking and killing Christians.
With only 1 minute, then, and no more here, Raymond, that term terrorist, is it particularly helpful, or does it, in fact, kind of offer some cover to Islam in general?
If you use it by itself, the way the administration does, then yeah, it does offer cover. But if you use it as a noun with an adjective in front of it, such as Islamic or Muslim terrorist, I think it's okay. But oftentimes, you know, they'll talk about Al-Qaeda, and there's absolutely no connection to Islam, not even to radical extremist Islamism. It's just they're just a bunch of murderers and terrorists, and that, of course, it brings more questions than answers, because, you know, what are you a terrorist about? What's your motivation? What's your ideology? And that, again, and by the way, under the Obama administration, this is the first president who has taken out all the terms from the intelligence community that have any relevance to Islam. So now you can't say Islamic terrorist, they'll say terrorist. And now, so it's an intellectual undermining to deal with the problem.
Raymond Ibrahim is Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum, and he's author of the new book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Raymond, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
In the next hour, we're going to discuss the Day of Pentecost, the original Day of Pentecost, that is in the New Testament. Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary will be our guest. Tomorrow on the program, we'll also be talking with Pastor Tom Baker about the Beatitudes. When we come back, Pentecost is a day before it was a day in Acts chapter 2. There's something that's being celebrated there. There's something that's already gathering the people together, but Jesus has sent his Holy Spirit, just as he has promised. And when we come back, Dr. Arthur Just will be our guest. We're going to talk about what happens on that first Pentecost, how it is that the author of the Gospel of Luke isn't done telling his story. He isn't done telling the story of Jesus' ministry. He isn't done telling the story of how Jesus has made promises regarding his disciples and the Holy Spirit he would send to them, how there is something that he is giving them to do. He's something that he is giving them, someone he is giving them, namely the Holy Spirit. All of that is wrapped up in the first Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary will be our guest to talk about the very first Pentecost as it is first recorded by Luke in his book of Acts, the follow-up to the gospel. And there's a reason why the two books are connected and why the second one begins with the fulfillment of that promise of the Holy Spirit. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. on this Monday afternoon, May the 20th, right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.